When GE decided in 2003 to spin off its insurance business into a separate company, WPP assembled a customized team to handle everything from the naming of the new company, Genworth, all the way down to its first advertising campaign and direct marketing program. As a leader within this organization, said Adamson, what you have to do is figure out the value proposition that is needed for each client and then identify and assemble the individual talents within WPP's workforce that will, in effect, form a virtual company just for that client. In the case of GE, we even gave a name to the virtual collaborative team we formed, Klamath Communications. When the world went flat, WPP adapted itself to get the most out of itself. It changed its office architecture and practices just like those companies that adjusted their steam-run factories to the electric motor. But WPP not only got rid of all its walls, it got rid of all its floors. It looked at all its employees from all its companies as a vast pool of individual specialists who could be assembled horizontally into collaborative teams, depending on the unique demands of any given project. And that team would then become a de facto new company with its own name. It will take time for this new playing field and the new business practices to be fully aligned. It's a work in progress. But here's a little warning. It is happening much faster than you think, and it is happening globally. Remember, this was a triple convergence. Convergence 3. Just as we finished creating this new, more horizontal playing field, and companies and individuals primarily in the West started quickly adapting to it, 3 billion people who had been frozen out of the field suddenly found themselves liberated to plug and play with everybody else. I am talking about the people of China, India, Russia, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and Central Asia. Their economies and political systems all opened up during the course of the 1990s so that their people were increasingly free to join the free market game. And when did these 3 billion people converge with the new playing field and the new processes? Right when the field was being flattened. Right when millions of them could compete and collaborate more equally, more horizontally, and with cheaper and more readily available tools than ever before. Indeed, thanks to the flattening of the world, many of these new entrants didn't even have to leave home to participate. Thanks to the 10 flatteners, the playing field came to them. It is this triple convergence of new players on a new playing field, developing new processes and habits for horizontal collaboration, that I believe is the most important force shaping global economics and politics in the early 21st century. Giving so many people access to all these tools of collaboration, along with the ability through search engines and the web to access billions of pages of raw information, ensures that the next generation of innovations will come from all over planet flat. The scale of the global community that is soon going to be able to participate in all sorts of discovery and innovation is something the world has simply never seen before. Here's what happened in round numbers. According to a November 2004 study by Harvard University economist Richard B. Freeman, in 1985, the global economic world comprised North America, Western Europe, Japan, as well as chunks of Latin America, Africa, and the countries of East Asia. The total population of this global economic world, taking part in international trade and commerce, said Freeman, was about 2.5 billion people. By 2000, as a result of the collapse of communism in the Soviet Empire, India's turn from autarky, China's shift to market capitalism, and population growth all over, the global economic world expanded to encompass 6 billion people. As a result of this widening, another roughly 1.5 billion new workers entered the global economic labor force, Freeman said, which is almost exactly double the number we would have had in 2000 had China, India, and the Soviet Empire not joined. And be advised, these new players are stepping onto the playing field legacy-free, meaning that many of them were so far behind they can leap right into the new technologies without having to worry about all the sunken costs of old systems. It means that they can move very fast to adopt new, state-of-the-art technologies, which is why there are already more cell phones in use in China today than there are people in the United States. Many Chinese just skipped over the landline phase. South Koreans put Americans to shame in terms of internet usage and broadband penetration. We tend to think of global trade and economics as something driven by the IMF, the G8, the World Bank, the WTO, and the trade treaties forged by trade ministers. I don't want to suggest that these governmental agencies are irrelevant. They are not. But they are going to become less important. In the future, globalization is going to be increasingly driven by the individuals who understand the flat world, adapt themselves quickly to its processes and technologies, and start to march forward without any treaties or advice from the IMF. They will be every color of the rainbow and from every corner of the world. The global economy from here forward will be shaped less by the ponderous deliberations of finance ministers and more by the spontaneous explosion of energy from the zippies. Yes, Americans grew up with the hippies in the 1960s. Thanks to the high-tech revolution, many of us became yuppies in the 1980s. Well, now let me introduce the zippies. "The zippies are here," declared the Indian weekly magazine Outlook. Zippies are the huge cohort of Indian youth who are the first to come of age since India shifted away from socialism and dived headfirst into global trade and the information revolution by turning itself into the world service center. Outlook called India's zippies liberalization's children and defined a zippy as a young city or suburban resident between 15 and 25 years of age with a zip in the stride. Belongs to Generation Z. Can be male or female, studying or working. Oozes attitude, ambition, and aspiration. Cool, confident, and creative. Seeks challenges, loves risks, and shuns fear. Indian zippies feel no guilt about making money or spending it. They are, says one Indian analyst quoted by Outlook, destination-driven, not destiny-driven, outward-looking, not inward, upwardly mobile, not stuck in my station in life. With 54% of India under the age of 25, that's 555 million people, 6 out of 10 Indian households have at least one potential zippy. And the zippies don't just have a pent-up demand for good jobs, they want the good life. One of the most dynamic pluggers and players I met in India was Rajesh Rayo, founder and CEO of Dhruva Interactive, a small Indian game company based in Bangalore. If I could offer you one person who embodies the triple convergence, it is Rajesh. He and his firm show us what happens when an Indian zippy plugs into the 10 flatteners. Dhruva is located in a converted house on a quiet street in a residential neighborhood of Bangalore. When I stopped in for a visit, I found two floors of Indian game designers and artists trained in computer graphics working on PCs, drawing various games and animated characters for American and European clients. Dhruva has already produced some very innovative games, from a computer tennis game you can play on the screen of your cell phone to a computer pool game you can play on your PC or laptop. I asked Rajesh, who is in his early 30s, to walk me through how he became a player in the global game business from Bangalore. "The first defining moment for me dates back to the early 90s, said Rajesh, a smallish, mustachioed figure with the ambition of a heavyweight boxer. "I started my company in Bangalore as a one-man operation on March 15, 1995. By 1997, we were a five-man team. We had done some path-breaking work in our chosen field, but we realized that this was not challenging us enough. In March 1997, we partnered with Intel and began the process of reinventing ourselves into a gaming company. By mid-1998, we were showing global players what we were capable of by way of both designing games and developing the outsourced portions of games designed by others. On November 26, 1998, we signed our first major game development project with Infogrames Entertainment, a French gaming company. In hindsight, I think the deal we landed was due to the pragmatism of one man in Infogrames more than anything else. We did a great job on the game, but it was never published. It was a big blow for us, but the quality of our work spoke for itself, so we survived. The most important lesson we learned? We could do it, but we had to get smart. We had to look at positioning ourselves differently. In March 2001, we sent out our new game demo, Saloon, to the world, said Rajesh. The theme was the American Wild Wild West, and the setting was a saloon in a small town after business hours, with the barman cleaning up. None of us had ever seen a real saloon before, but we researched the look and feel of a saloon using the internet and Google. The choice of the theme was deliberate. We wanted potential clients in the USA and Europe to be convinced that Indians can get it. The demo was a hit. It landed us a bunch of outsourced business, and we have been a successful company ever since. Could he have done this a decade earlier, before the world got so flat? Never, said Rajesh. Several things had to come together. The first was to have enough installed bandwidth so he could email game content and instructions back and forth between his own company and his American clients. The second factor, said Rajesh, was the spread of PCs for use in both business and at home, with people getting very comfortable using them in a variety of tasks. PCs are everywhere, he said. The penetration is relatively decent even in India today. The third factor, though, was the emergence of the workflow software and internet applications that made it possible for a Dhruva to go into business as a mini multinational from day one. Word, Outlook, NetMeeting, 3D Studio Max. But Google is the key. It's fantastic, said Rajesh. One of the things that's always an issue for our clients from the West is, will you Indians be able to understand the subtle nuances of Western content? Now, to a large extent, it was a very valid question. But the internet has helped us to be able to aggregate different kinds of content at the touch of a button. And today, if someone asks you to make something that looks like Tom and Jerry, you just say, Google Tom and Jerry, and you've got tons and tons of pictures and information and reviews and write-ups about Tom and Jerry, which you can read and simulate. While people were focusing on the boom and bust of the dot-coms, Rajesh explained, the real revolution was taking place more quietly. It was the fact that all over the world, people, en masse, were starting to get comfortable with the new global infrastructure. We are just at the beginning of being efficient in using it, he said. There is a lot more we can do with this infrastructure as more and more people shift to becoming paperless in their offices and realize that distances really do not matter. It will supercharge all of this. It's really going to be a different world. The internet now makes this whole world like one marketplace, added Rajesh. This infrastructure is not only going to facilitate sourcing of work to the best price, best quality, from the best place, it is also going to enable a great amount of sharing of practices and knowledge, and it's going to be, I can learn from you and you can learn from me like never before. It's very good for the world. The economy is going to drive integration, and the integration is going to drive the economy. There is no reason the United States should not benefit from this trend, Rajesh insisted. What Dhruva is doing is pioneering computer gaming within Indian society. When the Indian market starts to embrace gaming as a mainstream social activity, Dhruva will already be positioned to take advantage. But by then, he argued, the market will be so huge that there will be a lot of opportunity for content to come from outside. And hey, the Americans are way ahead in terms of the ability to know what games can work and what won't work in terms of being at the cutting edge of design, so this is a bilateral thing. Every perceived dollar or opportunity that is lost today, from an American point of view because of outsourcing, is actually going to come back to you times 10, once the market here is unleashed. Just remember, we are a 300 million middle class, larger than the size of your country or Europe. Instead of complaining about outsourcing, said Rajesh, Americans and Western Europeans would be better off thinking about how you can raise your bar and raise yourselves into doing something better. Americans have consistently led in innovation over the last century. Americans whining? We have never seen that before. People like me have learned a lot from Americans. We have learned to become a little more aggressive in the way we market ourselves, which is something we would not have done given our typical British background. So what is your overall message? I asked Rajesh before leaving with my head spinning. My message is that what's happening now is just the tip of the iceberg. What is really necessary is for everybody to wake up to the fact that there is a fundamental shift that is happening in the way people are going to do business. And everyone is going to have to improve themselves and be able to compete. It is just going to be one global market. Look, we just made baseball caps for Dhruva to give away. They came from Sri Lanka. Not from a factory in South Bangalore? I asked. Not from South Bangalore, said Rajesh, even though Bangalore is one of the export hubs for garments. Among the three or four caps we got quotations for, this Sri Lankan one was the best in terms of quality and the right price, and we thought the finish was great. This is the situation you are going to see moving forward, Rajesh concluded. If you are seeing all this energy coming out of Indians, it's because we have been underdogs and we have that drive to kind of achieve and to get there. India is going to be a superpower and we are going to rule. Rule whom? I asked. Rajesh laughed at his own choice of words. It's not about ruling anybody, that's the point. There is nobody to rule anymore. It's about how you can create a great opportunity for yourself and hold on to that or keep creating new opportunities where you can thrive. I think today that rule is about efficiency. It's about collaboration and it is about competitiveness and it is about being a player. It is about staying sharp and being in the game. The world is a football field now and you've got to be sharp to be on the team which plays on that field. If you're not good enough, you're going to be sitting and watching the game. That's all. Well, here's the truth no one wanted to tell you. The world has been flattened. As a result of the triple convergence, global collaboration and competition between individuals and individuals, companies and individuals, companies and companies, and companies and customers have been made cheaper, easier, more friction-free, and more productive for more people from more corners of the earth than at any time in the history of the world. The Great Sorting Out. In the wake of this triple convergence that we have just gone through, we are going to witness what I call the Great Sorting Out. Because when the world starts to move from a primarily vertical, command and control, value creation model to an increasingly horizontal, connect and collaborate creation model, it doesn't affect just how business gets done. It affects everything. How communities and companies define themselves, where companies and communities stop and start, how individuals balance their different identities as consumers, employees, shareholders, and citizens, and what role government has to play. All of this is going to have to be sorted out anew. The most common disease of the flat world is going to be multiple identity disorder, which is why, if nothing else, political scientists are going to have a field day with the flat world. I first began thinking about the Great Sorting Out after a conversation with Harvard University's noted political theorist Michael J. Sandel. Sandel startled me slightly by remarking that the sort of flattening process that I was describing was actually first identified by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the Communist Manifesto, published in 1848. While the shrinking and flattening of the world that we are seeing today constitute a difference of degree from what Marx saw happening in his day, said Sandel, it is nevertheless part of the same historical trend Marx highlighted in his writings on capitalism, the inexorable march of technology and capital to remove all barriers, boundaries, frictions, and restraints to global commerce. Referring to the Communist Manifesto, Sandel told me, "You are arguing something similar. What you are arguing is that the developments in information technology are enabling companies to squeeze out all the inefficiencies and friction from their markets and business operations. That is what your notion of flattening really means. But a flat, frictionless world is a mixed blessing. It may, as you suggest, be good for global business, or it may, as Marx believed, augur well for a proletarian revolution. But it may also pose a threat to the distinctive places and communities that give us our bearings, that locate us in the world. From the first stirrings of capitalism, people have imagined the possibility of the world as a perfect market, unimpeded by protectionist pressures, disparate legal systems, cultural and linguistic differences, or ideological disagreement. But this vision has always bumped up against the world as it actually is, full of sources of friction and inefficiency. Some obstacles to a frictionless global market are truly sources of waste and lost opportunities. But some of these inefficiencies are institutions, habits, cultures, and traditions that people cherish precisely because they reflect non-market values like social cohesion, religious faith, and national pride. If global markets and new communications technologies flatten those differences, we may lose something important. That is why the debate about capitalism has been, from the very beginning, about which frictions, barriers, and boundaries are mere sources of waste and inefficiency, and which are sources of identity and belonging that we should try to protect. From the telegraph to the internet, every new communications technology has promised to shrink the distance between people, to increase access to information, and to bring us ever closer to the dream of a perfectly efficient, frictionless global market. And each time, the question for society arises with renewed urgency: to what extent should we stand aside, get with the program, and do all we can to squeeze out yet more inefficiencies? And to what extent should we lean against the current for the sake of values that global markets can't supply? Some sources of friction are worth protecting, even in the face of a global economy that threatens to flatten them. The biggest source of friction, of course, has always been the nation-state, with its clearly defined boundaries and laws. Are national boundaries a source of friction we should want to preserve, or even can preserve in a flat world? What about legal barriers to the free flow of information, intellectual property, and capital, such as copyrights, worker protections, and minimum wages? In the wake of the triple convergence, the more the flattening forces reduce friction and barriers, the sharper the challenge they will pose to the nation-state and to the particular cultures, values, national identities, democratic traditions, and bonds of restraint that have historically provided some protection and cushioning for workers and communities. Which do we keep and which do we let melt away into air so we can all collaborate more easily? This will take some sorting out, which is why the point that Michael Sandel raises is critical and is sure to be at the forefront of political debate both within and between nation-states in the flat world. As Sandel argued, what I call collaboration could be seen by others as just a nice name for the ability to hire cheap labor in India. You cannot deny that when you look at it from an American perspective. But that is only if you look at it from one side. From the Indian workers' perspective, that same form of collaboration, outsourcing, could be seen as another name for empowering individuals in the developing world as never before, enabling them to nurture, exploit, and profit from their God-given intellectual talents, talents that before the flattening of the world often rotted on the docks of Bombay and Calcutta. In the flat world, one person's economic liberation could be another's unemployment. Consider this case of multiple identity disorder. In 2003, the state of Indiana put out to bid a contract to upgrade the state's computer systems that process unemployment claims. Guess who won? Tata America International, which is the U.S.-based subsidiary of India's Tata Consultancy Services Limited. Tata's bid of $15.2 million came in $8.1 million lower than that of its closest rivals, the New York-based companies Del Watt Consulting and Accenture Limited. No Indiana firms bid on the contract because it was too big for them to handle. In other words, an Indian consulting firm won the contract to upgrade the unemployment department of the state of Indiana. You couldn't make this up. Tata was planning to send some 65 contract employees to work in the Indiana Government Center alongside 18 state workers. Tata also said it would hire local subcontractors and do some local recruiting, but most workers would come from India to do the computer overhauls, which, once completed, were supposed to speed the processing of unemployment claims as well as save postage and reduce hassles for businesses that pay unemployment taxes. The Indianapolis Star reported on June 25, 2004. You can probably guess how the story ended. Top aides to then-Governor Frank O'Bannon had signed off on the politically sensitive 4-year contract before his death on September 13, 2003, the Star reported. But when word of the contract was made public, Republicans made it a campaign issue. It became such a political hot potato that Governor Joe Kernan, a Democrat who had succeeded O'Bannon, ordered the state agency, which helps out-of-work Indiana residents, to cancel the contract, and also to put up some legal barriers and friction to prevent such a thing from happening again. He also ordered that the contract be broken up into smaller bites that Indiana firms could bid for. Good for Indiana firms, but very costly and inefficient for the state. So now I have just one simple question. Who is the exploiter and who is the exploited in this India-Indiana story? In the old world, where value was largely being created vertically, usually within a single company and from the top down, it was very easy to see who was on the top and who was on the bottom, who was exploiting and who was being exploited. But when the world starts to flatten out through multiple forms of collaboration, in which individuals and little guys have much more power, who is on the top and who is on the bottom, who is exploiter and who is exploited, gets very complicated. Some of our old political reflexes no longer apply. Were the Indian engineers not being exploited when their government educated them in some of the best technical institutes in the world inside India, but then that same Indian government pursued a socialist economic policy that could not provide those engineers with work in India so that those who could not get out of India had to drive taxis to eat? Are those same engineers now being exploited when they join the biggest consulting company in India, are paid a very comfortable wage in Indian terms, and, thanks to the flat world, can now apply their skills globally? Or are those Indian engineers now exploiting the people of Indiana by offering to revamp their state unemployment system for much less money than an American consulting firm? Or were the people of Indiana exploiting those cheaper Indian engineers? The India versus Indiana dispute highlights the difficulties in drawing lines between the interests of two communities that never before imagined they were connected, much less collaborators. But suddenly they each woke up and discovered that in a flat world where work increasingly becomes a horizontal collaboration, they were not only connected and collaborating, but badly in need of a social contract to govern their relations. The larger point here is this. Whether we are talking about management science or political science, manufacturing or research and development, many, many players and processes are going to have to come to grips with horizontalization, and it is going to take a lot of sorting out. Just as the relationship between different groups of workers will have to be sorted out in a flat world, so too will the relationship between companies and the communities in which they operate. Whose values will govern a particular company, and whose interests will that company respect and promote? It used to be said that as General Motors goes, so goes America. But today it would be said, as Dell goes, so goes Malaysia, Taiwan, China, Ireland, India. HP today has 142,000 employees in 178 countries. It is not only the largest consumer technology company in the world, it is the largest IT company in Europe, the largest IT company in Russia, the largest IT company in the Middle East, and the largest IT company in South Africa. Is HP an American company if a majority of its employees and customers are outside of America, even though it is headquartered in Palo Alto? Corporations cannot survive today as entities bounded by any single nation-state, not even one as big as the United States. So the current keep-you-awake-at-night issue for nation-states and their citizens is how to deal with corporations that are no longer bounded by a thing called the nation-state. To whom are they loyal? On December 7, 2004, IBM announced that it was selling its whole personal computing division to the Chinese computer company Lenovo to create a new worldwide PC company, the globe's third largest, with approximately $12 billion in annual revenue. This new Chinese-owned computer company, headquartered in New York, with factories in Raleigh and Beijing, will have a Chinese chairman, an American CEO, an American CPO, and a Chinese CFO, and it will be listed on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Would you call this an American company? A Chinese company? Even identifying a company's country of origin today is getting harder and harder. Sir John Rose, the chief executive of Rolls-Royce, told me once, "We have a big business in Germany. We are the biggest high-tech employer in the state of Brandenburg. I was recently at a dinner with Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, and he said to me, 'You are a German company. Why don't you come along with me on my next visit to Russia to try to drum up business there for German companies?'" The German chancellor, said Rose, was recognizing that although my headquarters were in London, my business was involved in creating value in Germany, and that could be constructive in his relationship with Russia. Here you have the quintessential British company, Rolls-Royce, which, though still headquartered in England, now operates through a horizontal global supply chain, and its CEO, a British citizen knighted by the Queen, is being courted by the Chancellor of Germany to help him drum up business in Russia because one link in the Rolls-Royce supply chain happens to run through Brandenburg. Sort that out. Something else is absolutely going to have to be sorted out in a flat world. Who owns what? How do we build legal barriers to protect an innovator's intellectual property so he or she can reap its financial benefits and plow those profits into a new invention? And from the other side, how do we keep walls low enough so that we encourage the sharing of intellectual property, which is required more and more to do cutting-edge innovation? The flatter the world gets, the more we are going to need a system of global governance that keeps up with all the new legal and illegal forms of collaboration. We can also see this in the case of patent law as it has evolved inside the United States. Companies can do one of three things with an innovation. They can patent the widget they invent and sell it themselves. They can patent it and license it to someone else to manufacture, and they can patent it and cross-license with several other companies so that they all have freedom of action to make a product, like a PC, that comes from melding many different patents. American patent law is technically neutral on this. But the way established case law has evolved, experts tell me, it is decidedly biased against cross-licensing and other arrangements that encourage collaboration or freedom of action for as many players as possible. It is more focused on protecting the rights of individual firms to manufacture their own patents. In a flat world, companies need a patent system that encourages both. The more your legal structure fosters cross-licensing and standards, the more collaborative innovation you will get. The PC is the product of a lot of cross-licensing between the company that had the patent on the cursor and the company that had the patent on the mouse and the screen. The free software person in all of us wants no patent laws, but the innovator in all of us wants a global regime that protects against intellectual property piracy. The innovator in us also wants patent laws that encourage cross-licensing with companies that are ready to play by the rules. Who owns what is sure to emerge as one of the most contentious political and geopolitical questions in a flat world, especially if more and more American companies start feeling ripped off by more and more Chinese companies. If you are in the business of selling words, music, or pharmaceuticals, and you are not worried about protecting your intellectual property, you are not paying attention. In the fall of 2004, I went out to Minneapolis to visit my mother and had three World is Flat encounters right in a row. First, before I left home in Washington, I dialed 411, directory assistance, to try to get a friend's phone number in Minneapolis. A computer answered, and a computerized voice asked me to pronounce the name of the person whose number I was requesting. For whatever reason, I could not get the computer to hear me correctly, and it kept saying back to me in a computerized voice, "Did you say..." I kept having to say the family name in a voice that masked my exasperation, otherwise the computer never would have understood me. "No, I didn't say that. I said..." Eventually, I was connected to an operator, but I did not enjoy this friction-free encounter with directory information. I craved the friction of another human being. It may be cheaper and more efficient to have a computer dispense phone numbers, but for me, it brought only frustration. When I arrived in Minneapolis, I had dinner with family friends, one of whom has spent his life working as a wholesaler in the Midwest, selling goods to the biggest retailers in the region. He is a natural salesman. When I asked him what was new, he sighed and said that business just wasn't what it used to be. Everything was now being sold at 1% margins, he explained. No problem. He was selling mostly commodity items so that, given his volumes, he could handle the slim profit margin. But what bothered him, he mentioned, was the fact that he no longer had human contact with some of his biggest accounts. Even commodities and low-cost goods have certain differentiating elements that need to be sold and highlighted. "Everything is by email now," he said. "I am dealing with a young kid at one of the biggest retailers in the nation, and he says, 'Just email me your bid.' I've never met him. Half the time, he doesn't get back to me. I'm not sure how to deal with him. In the old days, I used to stop by the office, give the buyers a few Vikings tickets. We were friends. Tommy, all anyone cares about today is price." It's hard to create a human bond with email and streaming internet. The next day, I had dinner with my friend Ken Greer. Ken had a similar lament. So many contracts were going these days to the advertising firms that were selling just numbers, not creative instinct. Then Ken said something that really hit home with me. "It's like they've cut all the fat out of the business and turned everything into a numbers game. But fat is what gives meat its taste," Ken added. "The leanest cuts of meat don't taste very good. You want it marbled with at least a little fat." Yes, the consumer in us wants Walmart prices with all the fat gone, but the employee in us wants a little fat left on the bone, the way Costco does it, so that it can offer health care to almost all its employees, rather than just less than half of them as Walmart does. But the shareholder in us wants Walmart's profit margins, not Costco's. Yet the citizen in us wants Costco's benefits rather than Walmart's, because the difference ultimately may have to be paid for by society. The consumer in me wants lower phone bills, but the human being in me also wants to speak to an operator when I call 411. Given these conflicting emotions and pressures, there is a potential here for American politics to get completely reshuffled, with workers and corporate interests realigning themselves into different parties. Think about it. Social conservatives from the right wing of the Republican Party, who do not like globalization or closer integration with the world because it brings too many foreigners and foreign cultural mores into America, might align themselves with unions from the left wing of the Democratic Party, who don't like globalization for the way it facilitates the outsourcing and offshoring of jobs. They might be called the Wall Party and militate for more friction and fat everywhere. Meanwhile, the business wing of the Republican Party, which believes in free trade, deregulation, more integration, and lower taxes, everything that would flatten the world even more, may end up aligning itself with the social liberals of the Democratic Party, many of whom are East Coast or West Coast global service industry workers. They might also be joined by Hollywood and other entertainment workers. All of them are huge beneficiaries of the flat world. They might be called the Web Party, whose main platform would be to promote more global integration. In short, in a flat world, we are likely to see many social liberals, white-collar global service industry workers, and Wall Street types driven together, and many social conservatives, white-collar local service industry workers, and labor unions driven together. More and more, politics in the flat world will consist of asking which values, frictions, and fats are worth preserving, which should, in Marx's language, be kept solid, and which must be left to melt away into the air. Countries, companies, and individuals will be able to give intelligent answers to these questions only if they understand the real nature and texture of the global playing field, and how different it is from the one that existed in the Cold War era and before. And countries, companies, and individuals will be able to make sound political choices only if they fully appreciate the flattened playing field and understand all the new tools now available to them for collaborating and competing on it. I hope this audio program will provide a nuanced framework for this hugely important political debate and the great sorting out that is just around the corner. Brace yourself. You are now about to enter the flat world. America and the flat world. America and free trade. Is Ricardo still right? As an American who has always believed in the merits of free trade, I had an important question to answer after my India trip. Should I still believe in free trade in a flat world? I know that free trade won't necessarily benefit every American, and that our society will have to help those who are harmed by it. But for me, the key question was, will free trade benefit America as a whole when the world becomes so flat and so many more people can collaborate and compete with my kids? It seems that so many jobs are going to be up for grabs. Wouldn't individual Americans be better off if our government erected some walls and banned some outsourcing and offshoring? I first wrestled with this issue while filming the Discovery Times documentary in Bangalore. One day we went to the Infosys campus around 5 p.m., just when the Infosys call center workers were flooding into the grounds for the overnight shift on foot, minibus, and motor scooter. The crew and I were standing at the gate observing this river of educated young people flowing in and out, many in animated conversation. They all looked as if they had scored 1600 on their SATs, and I felt a real mind-eye split overtaking me. My mind just kept telling me, Ricardo is right, Ricardo is right, Ricardo is right. David Ricardo, 1772 to 1823, was the English economist who developed the free trade theory of comparative advantage, which stipulates that if each nation specializes in the production of goods in which it has a comparative cost advantage and then trades with other nations for the goods in which they specialize, there will be an overall gain in trade, and overall income levels should rise in each trading country. And one can see evidence of this mutual benefit in the sharp increase in exports and imports between the United States and India in recent years. Having listened to the arguments on both sides, though, I come down where the great majority of economists come down, that Ricardo is still right, and that more American individuals will be better off if we don't erect barriers to outsourcing, supply chaining, and offshoring than if we do. The main argument of the anti-outsourcing school is that in a flat world, not only are goods tradable, but many services have become tradable as well. Because of this change, America and other developed countries could be headed for an absolute decline, not just a relative one, in their economic power and living standards unless they move to formally protect certain jobs from foreign competition. So many new players cannot enter the global economy, in service and knowledge fields now dominated by the Americans, Europeans, and Japanese, without wages settling at a newer, lower equilibrium, this school argues. The main counterargument from free trade slash outsourcing advocates is that while there may be a transition phase in certain fields, during which wages are dampened, there is no reason to believe that this dip will be permanent or across the board, as long as the global pie keeps growing. To suggest that it will be is to invoke the so-called lump of labor theory, the notion that there is a fixed lump of labor in the world and that once that lump is gobbled up, by either Americans or Indians or Japanese, there won't be any more jobs to go around. The main reason the lump of labor theory is wrong is that it is based on the assumption that everything that is going to be invented has been invented, and that therefore economic competition is a zero-sum game, a fight over a fixed lump. This assumption misses the fact that although jobs are often lost in bulk, to outsourcing or offshoring, by big individual companies, and this loss tends to make headlines, new jobs are also being created in fives, tens, and twenties by small companies that you can't see. It often takes a leap of faith to believe that it is happening, but it is happening. The reason it is happening is that as lower-end service and manufacturing jobs move out of Europe, America, and Japan to India, China, and the former Soviet Empire, the global pie not only grows larger because more people have more income to spend, it also grows more complex as more new jobs and new specialties are created. The pie keeps growing because things that look like wants today are needs tomorrow, argued Marc Andreessen, the Netscape co-founder, who helped to ignite a whole new industry, e-commerce, that now employs millions of specialists around the world, specialists whose jobs weren't even imagined when Bill Clinton became president. I like going to coffee shops occasionally, but now that Starbucks is here, I need my coffee. And that new need has spawned a whole new industry. I always wanted to be able to search for things, but once Google was created, I must have my search engine. So a whole new industry has been built up around search, and Google is hiring math PhDs by the bushel before Yahoo or Microsoft hires them. People are always assuming that everything that is going to be invented must have been invented already, but it hasn't. If you believe human wants and needs are infinite, said Andreessen, then there are infinite industries to be created, infinite businesses to be started, and infinite jobs to be done, and the only limiting factor is human imagination. The world is flattening and rising at the same time, and I think the evidence is overwhelmingly clear. If you look over the sweep of history, every time we had more trade, more communications, we had a big upswing in economic activity and standard of living. Look at what is happening already. As American companies send knowledge work to India, Indian companies are turning around and using their earnings and insights to start inventing new products that poorer Indians can use to lift themselves out of poverty into the middle class, where they will surely become consumers of American products. Raghuram Rajan, the director of research for the International Monetary Fund, sits on the board of a company that puts Indian students to work tutoring students in Singapore. The students, from the Indian Institute of Technology in Madras, go online to help students in Singapore from grades 6 to 12 on their math homework. They also help teachers in Singapore develop lesson plans and prepare PowerPoint presentations or other jazzy ways for them to teach math. The company, called HeyMath.com, is paid for by the schools in Singapore. Cambridge University in England is also part of this equation, providing the overall quality controls and certifying the lesson plans and teaching methods. Everyone wins, says Rajan. The company is run by two Indians who worked for Citibank and CSFB in London and came back to India to start this business. Cambridge University is making money from a company that has created a whole new niche. The Indian students are making pocket money, and the Singapore students are learning better. Meanwhile, the underlying software is probably being provided by Microsoft and the chips by Intel, and the enriched Indian students are probably buying cheap personal computers from Apple, Dell, or HP. but you can't really see any of this. The pie grew, but no one saw it, said Rajan. It is so easy to demonize free markets and the freedom to outsource and offshore because it is so much easier to see people being laid off than being hired. But occasionally, a newspaper tries to dig deep into the issue. My hometown paper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, did just that. It looked at exactly how the Minnesota economy was being affected by the flattening of the world, actually daring to run an article on September 5, 2004, headlined, "Offshore Jobs Bring Gains at Home." The article, datelined Wuxi, China, began like this. Outside, the air is dank, dusty, and hot as tropical fever. Inside, in an environment that's dry, spotless, and cool, hundreds of former farm laborers covered head to toe in suits looking like something out of NASA are performing work for Bloomington-based Donaldson Company, Inc. In Donaldson's case, the company has twice as many workers in China, 2,500, as the 1,100 it has in Bloomington. The Chinese operation not only has allowed Donaldson to keep making a product it no longer could make at a profit in the United States, it also has helped boost the company's Minnesota employment, up by 400 people since 1990. Donaldson's highly paid engineers, chemists, and designers in Minnesota spend their days designing updated filters that the Chinese plant will make for use in computers, MP3 players, and digital video recorders. The falling disk drive prices made possible by Chinese production are feeding demand for the gadgets. If we didn't follow the trend, we'd be out of business, said David Tim, general manager of Donaldson's disk drive and microelectronics unit. In Minnesota, Global Insight estimates that 1,854 jobs were created as a result of foreign outsourcing in 2003. By 2008, the firm expects nearly 6,700 new jobs in Minnesota as a consequence of the trend. Economists often compare China's and India's entry into the global economy to the moment when the railroad lines crossing America finally connected New Mexico to California, with its much larger population. When the railroad comes to town, noted Vivek Paul, the YPRO president, the first thing you see is extra capacity, and all the people in New Mexico say those people, Californians, will wipe out all our factories along the line. That will happen in some areas, and some companies along the line will go out of business. But then capital will get reallocated. In the end, everyone along the line will benefit. Sure, there is fear, and that fear is good, because that stimulates a willingness to change and explore and find more things to do better. It happened when we connected New York, New Mexico, and California. It happened when we connected Western Europe, America, and Japan. And it will happen when we connect India and China with America, Europe, and Japan. The way to succeed is not by stopping the railroad line from connecting you, but by upgrading your skills and making the investment in those practices that will enable you and your society to claim your slice of the bigger but more complex pie.
The Untouchables: Finding the New Middle. If the flattening of the world is largely but not entirely unstoppable, and if it holds out the potential to be as beneficial to American society in general as past market evolutions have been, how does an individual get the best out of it? What do we tell our kids? My simple answer is this. There will be plenty of good jobs out there in the flat world for people with the right knowledge, skills, ideas, and self-motivation to seize them. But there is no sugarcoating the new challenge. Every young American today would be wise to think of himself or herself as competing against every young Chinese, Indian, and Brazilian. In Globalization 1.0, countries had to think globally to thrive, or at least survive. In Globalization 2.0, companies had to think globally to thrive, or at least survive. In Globalization 3.0, individuals have to think globally to thrive or at least survive. This requires not only a new level of technical skills, but also a certain mental flexibility, self-motivation, and psychological mobility. I am certain that we Americans can indeed thrive in this world, but I am also certain that it will not be as easy as it was in the last 50 years. Each of us, as an individual, will have to work a little harder and run a little faster to keep our standard of living rising. Globalization went from globalizing industries to globalizing individuals, said Vivek Paul, the Wipro president. I think today that people working in most jobs can sense how what they are doing integrates globally. I am working with someone in India. I am buying from someone in China. I am selling to someone in England. As a result of the ability to move work around, we have created an amazing awareness on the part of every individual that says, not only does my work have to fit into somebody's global supply chain, but I myself have to understand how I need to compete and have the skill sets required to work at a pace that fits the supply chain. And I had better be able to do that as well or better than anyone else in the world. That sense of responsibility for one's own advancement runs deeper than ever today. In many global industries now, you have got to justify your job every day with the value you create and the unique skills you contribute. And if you don't, that job can fly away farther and faster than ever. In sum, it was never good to be mediocre in your job, but in a world of walls, mediocrity could still earn you a decent wage. You could get by and then some. In a flatter world, you really do not want to be mediocre or lack any passion for what you do. You do not want to find yourself in the shoes of Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman when his son Biff dispels his idea that the Loman family is special by declaring, "Pop, I'm a dime a dozen, and so are you." An angry Willie retorts, "I am not a dime a dozen. I am Willie Loman. And you are Biff Loman." I don't care to have that conversation with my girls, so my advice to them in this flat world is very brief and very blunt. Girls, when I was growing up, my parents used to say to me, "Tom, finish your dinner. People in China and India are starving." My advice to you is, girls, finish your homework. People in China and India are starving for your jobs. And in a flat world, they can have them. Because in a flat world, there is no such thing as an American job. There is just a job. And in more cases than ever before, it will go to the best, smartest, most productive, or cheapest worker, wherever he or she resides. The new middle. It is going to take more than just doing your homework to thrive in a flat world, though. You are going to have to do the right kind of homework as well. Because the companies that are adjusting best to the flat world are not just making minor changes. They are changing the whole model of the work they do and how they do it in order to take advantage of the flat world platform and to compete with others who are doing the same. What this means is that students also have to fundamentally reorient what they are learning and educators how they are teaching it. They can't just keep the same old model that worked for the past 50 years, when the world was round. This set of issues is what I will explore in this and the next chapter. What kind of good middle-class jobs are successful companies and entrepreneurs creating today? How do workers need to prepare themselves for those jobs? And how can educators help them do just that? Let's start at the beginning. The key to thriving as an individual in a flat world is figuring out how to make yourself an untouchable. That's right. When the world goes flat, the caste system gets turned upside down. In India, untouchables are the lowest social class. But in a flat world, everyone should want to be an untouchable. Untouchables, in my lexicon, are people whose jobs cannot be outsourced, digitized, or automated. And remember, as analyst David Rothkopf notes, most jobs are not lost to outsourcing to India or China. Most lost jobs are outsourced to the past. That is, they get digitized and automated. The New York Times Washington Bureau used to have a telephone operator receptionist. Now it has a recorded greeting and voicemail. That reception job didn't go to India. It went to the past, or it went to a microchip. The flatter the world gets, the more anything that can be digitized, automated, or outsourced will be digitized, automated, or outsourced. As Infosys CEO Nandan Nilekani likes to say, in a flat world, there is fungible and non-fungible work. Work that can be easily digitized, automated, or transferred abroad is fungible. One of the most distinguishing features of the flat world is how many jobs, not just blue-collar manufacturing jobs, but now also white-collar service jobs, are becoming fungible. Since more of us work in those service jobs than ever before, more of us will be affected. Of course, not everything can be traded across national borders. Alan Blinder, the noted Princeton economist and former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, argued in a very smart essay titled Fear of Offshoring. He explained, "At any point in time, the available technology, especially transportation and communications technologies, largely determines which goods and services are easy to trade internationally and which are hard or impossible to trade. Simplifying this underlying reality, economic theorists typically conceptualize the world's goods and services as falling into one of two bins, tradable or non-tradable, what Nilekani calls fungible and non-fungible. Traditionally, any item that can be put in a box and shipped, roughly manufactured goods, was considered tradable, while anything that cannot be put in a box, like services, or was too heavy for shipping, like cement, was thought of as non-tradable. But that is now vestigial thinking. Because technology is constantly improving, and because transportation seems to grow easier and cheaper over time, the boundary between what is tradable and what is not tradable is constantly shifting. Over time, more and more things become tradable. In particular, boxes are simply not what they once were. The old assumption that if you can put it in a box, you can trade it, is now hopelessly obsolete, because packets of digitized information can now play the role that boxes used to play. Many services are now tradable, and many more will surely become so. Indeed, let me make a bold prediction. In the future, and to a great extent already in the present, the key distinction for international trade will no longer be things that can be put in a box and things that cannot. It will instead be between services that can be delivered electronically over long distances with little or no degradation of quality and those that cannot. The tradability of a vast array of services is, as they say, the new thing. And there is little doubt that the fraction of services that can be delivered electronically will grow. Princeton University Center for Economic Policy Studies Working Paper Number 119, December 2005. So if that is the direction of the global economy, who will the untouchables be? What jobs are not likely to become fungible, easy to automate, digitize, or outsource? I would argue that the untouchables in a flat world will fall into three broad categories. First are people who are really special or specialized. This label would apply to Michael Jordan, Madonna, Elton John, J.K. Rowling, your brain surgeon, and the top cancer researcher at the National Institutes of Health. These people perform functions in ways that are so special or specialized that they can never be outsourced, automated, or made tradable by electronic transfer. They are untouchables. They have a global market for their goods and services and can command global wages. Second are people who are really localized and anchored. This category includes many, many people. They are untouchables because their jobs must be done in a specific location, either because they involve some specific local knowledge or because they require face-to-face personalized contact or interaction with a customer, client, patient, colleague, or audience. All these people are untouchables because they are anchored. My barber, the waitress at lunch, the chefs in the kitchen, the plumber, nurses, my dentist, lounge singers, masseurs, retail sales clerks, repairmen, electricians, nannies, gardeners, cleaning ladies, and divorce lawyers. Note that these people can be working in high-end jobs, divorce lawyer, dentist, vocational jobs, plumber, carpenter, or low-end jobs, garbage collector, maid. Regardless of that worker's level of sophistication, their wages will be set by the local market forces of supply and demand. That then brings me to the third broad category. This category includes people in many formerly middle-class jobs, from assembly line work to data entry to securities analysis to certain forms of accounting and radiology that were once deemed non-fungible or non-tradable and are now being made quite fungible and tradable thanks to the 10 flatteners. Let's call these the old middle jobs. Many of them are now under pressure from the flattening of the world. As Nanda Nilekani puts it, "The problem for America is in the middle, because the days when you could count on being an accounts payable clerk are gone, and a lot of the middle class are where that old middle is. The middle has not yet grasped the competitive intensity of the future. Unless they do, they will not make the investments in reskilling themselves, and you will end up with a lot of people stranded on an island." That is not something we want. The American economy used to look like a bell curve, with a big bulge in the middle. That bulge of middle-class jobs has been the foundation not only of our economic stability, but of our political stability as well. Democracy cannot be stable without a broad and deep middle class. We cannot afford to move from a bell curve economy to a barbell economy, with a big high end and a bigger low end, and nothing in the middle. It would be economically unfair and politically unstable. As former Clinton National Economic Advisor Gene Sperling rightly argues, we either grow together or we will grow apart. So if the next new thing is the automation and outsourcing of more and more old middle-class jobs, then the big question for America and every other developed country is this: what will be the jobs of the new middle? And what skills will they be based on? In the United States, new middle jobs are coming into being all the time. That is why we don't have large-scale unemployment, despite the flattening of the world. But to get and keep these new middle jobs, you need certain skills that are suited to the flat world. Skills that can make you, at least temporarily, special, specialized, or anchored, and therefore, at least temporarily, an untouchable. In the new middle, we are all temps now. The new middlers. What are those skills? In order to answer this question, I worked backward. I went out to successful flat world companies around America and asked a simple question. Obviously, you have a lot of good middle class jobs here. Who works here and what sorts of things do they do? What follows is a general list of categories that many new middle jobs will fall into or grow out of, and the skill sets they require. To put it another way, here is what the help wanted ads look like in a flat world. Great collaborators and orchestrators. Clearly, a lot of new middle jobs will involve collaborating with others or orchestrating collaboration within and between companies, especially those employing diverse workforces from around the world. So as more and more companies start out from day one as global companies with global supply chains, a key new middle job will be that of the manager who can work in and orchestrate 24/7/7 supply chains, which are supply chains that run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, across 7 continents. I first started to realize this in the summer of 2005 when I took my daughter Orly to Bangalore, where she volunteered as a teacher in a school outside of town. One day she joined me on a visit to my friends at Infosys. When we arrived at the Infosys headquarters, a spokeswoman gave us a tour of the building. As we walked through the halls, she said to me in passing, "Our interns heard that you were going to be here today and asked if you would come and speak to them." "Sure," I said. "I'd love to speak to the interns. I always love interacting with these young Indians." "No, no," she said. "It's our American interns."
"You have American interns at Infosys?"
"They sure did," she told me. For its 100 internship positions that summer, Infosys received about 9,000 applications, primarily from North America, China, France, and Germany. I asked one of these interns, Vicky Chen, a Chinese-American business student from the Claremont Colleges in California, why she had sought out an internship in Bangalore. "All the business is coming to India, and I don't see why I shouldn't follow the business," she said. "If this is where the center of gravity is, you should go check it out, and then you become more valuable." As Infosys CEO Nilekani pointed out to me, even though Infosys is one of the biggest outsourcing firms in the world headquartered in Bangalore, 30% of our employees are outside of India, around the world, working at the front end, soliciting new business, implementing new software, and servicing existing accounts. "There will be a lot of good jobs that will involve being at the front end of this new global collaboration model," said Nilekani. "Suppose you are working for a big pharma company and it starts doing a lot more research in India. You will need people to talk to the FDA in Washington and deal with the local marketplace. There is always a local phase to this global process. These new middle jobs will be in sales, marketing, maintenance, and management. But what they will all demand is the ability to be a good horizontal collaborator, comfortable working for a global company, one whose headquarters may be in Beijing or Bangalore, not Boston, and translating its services for the local market, wherever that may be. It is about being able to operate in, mobilize, inspire, and manage a multidimensional and multicultural workforce. At the same time, because many more products will be made in global supply chains, many new middle jobs will involve making supply chains more efficient. The more complex the globalized networks," says Carlota Perez, a Venezuelan-born expert on technology and socioeconomic development, who is best known for her detailed tracking of large techno-economic paradigm shifts, "the more companies will need various forms of coordination and management around specifications, compatibility, research and design, global marketing, distribution chains, data sharing and storage, and security. There will be a lot of good new middle jobs along that chain." The Great Synthesizers. The further we push out the boundaries of knowledge and innovation, the more the next great value breakthroughs, that is, the next new hot-selling products and services, will come from putting together disparate things that you would not think of as going together. Search engine optimizing, for example, brings together mathematicians and marketing experts. The next great breakthrough in bioscience is going to result from computer engineers who can map the human genome, working with pharma companies that can turn these insights into life-saving drugs. This synthesis is where the new jobs are going to emerge. As I write this chapter, one of the hottest new businesses involves what is called mashups, where you just mash together two different web-based tools. So, for instance, some local realtors might mash together Craigslist.org with Google.com, which would mean matching up the local online directory of everyone selling a house or renting an apartment in a particular town with Google's Maps, instantly producing a real estate map that pinpoints every one of those houses and rental properties and is updated every second. "Can you bring an artist and clinical engineer together?" Infosys Chief Operating Officer S. Chris Gopalakrishnan asked me one day in Bangalore. "If the value comes from synthesizing, then you need synthesizers. Conventionally, your approach to any problem or challenge was breaking it down to manageable bits and smaller parts. But today, you are trying to create value by synthesizing disparate parts together. IBM used to make the chip, the computer, and the software all vertically, all by itself. But if you look at Dell, it does very little design and manufacturing. It brings all of the parts together from others and puts them in front of the customer. Dell's value is its ability to synthesize much better than everyone else. Synthesizing it all together around consumer demand is the key. So, in an organization, you need the dot people and the big picture people who can connect the dots. And the change that is happening in India and at Infosys is that we are moving more into the capability of creating the synthesis for the client. We understand the trends in the industry and anticipate trends and come out with a synthesized solution. Jeff Wacker, who works as the futurist for Electronic Data Systems Corporation, EDS, which I will discuss later, once wrote a company memo predicting which jobs would not be around in 15 or 20 years. His first category was the CIO. "There will still be a CIO," he wrote, "but the chief information officer will be replaced with a chief integration officer. Information technology will be so fully embedded in every aspect of a business that the IT organization will move away from technology to the integration of business processes." The Great Explainers. The more we have good synthesizers who can bring disparate things together, the more we will need managers, writers, teachers, producers, journalists, and editors who are also good explainers, who can see the complexity but explain it with simplicity. Marcia Lowry is an enterprise architect who also works for EDS. She is a classic example of a new middler. One reason is that she learned how to be a great explainer. It is more important to be able to explain something to someone else than to sit down and do the work yourself, she explained to me on a visit to EDS headquarters. "I have fields of people who can distribute software," she said, "but someone has to go in front of that customer and explain, here is what this is going to do for you, here is how it will tie into your existing systems, here is how it will benefit you, and here is how much it will cost." Think about it. If you can explain the complexity well, you can see the opportunities better. For instance, you can see what parts to synthesize. At the same time, the more content you can search and access, the more important the filters and explainers become. Amazon.com's value is not just selling you the book for 30% off the cover price, but actually helping you sort through the ocean of books out there very quickly and easily so you find the books you might be interested in reading. Howard Freeman, 53, owns a custom photography lab in Aspen, Colorado called Slidemaster Photo Imaging. We met quite by accident. He was my ski instructor. Over lunch one day at the top of Snowmass Mountain, he explained to me how his business was evolving, and I explained to him, on the basis of what he explained to me, that he had just entered the new middle as a great explainer. Let me explain. When Freeman started his business in 1977, he specialized in processing, duplicating, and making enlargements of slides taken by professional photographers, such as those on assignment for Architectural Digest or by advanced amateurs. But thanks to the triple convergence and the rise of digital photography, the number of people shooting slide film or any film dramatically diminished.